Find out how easy it is to de-anonymize your data. Firmware code for the new HomePod reveals secrets about the new iPhone. And Marques Brownlee is here to tell us about his hands-on with the new Tesla Model 3. All that and so much more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1821, recorded Monday, July 31st, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business with your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit. Welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we tell you what you need to know about technology that happened this very day. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. Sometimes it happened on Friday, but it was such a big thing that happened on Friday that we're going to go ahead and interview someone that was there.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Just saying that randomly.
Sometimes it happened last week, but we just heard about it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It all revolves around us and our experience, basically.
So
if we just heard about it, it's news to us, therefore it's news to you.
Right, exactly. I hope you don't know anything that we haven't told you, right? Because right. That would, yeah.
You aren't going online and doing your own research, are you? Mm. We got that, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got that.
All right.
So back in March, the U.S. Senate voted to overturn broadband privacy rules that had prevented ISPs from selling our browsing information. Now, a group at DEF CON last week presented evidence of just how easy it is for someone to de-anonymize that browsing data. Security experts Sve Eckhart and Andres Dues attempted to prove the consequences of the loss of broadband privacy when our ISP is able to sell our click streams, if you will. That's the specifically tracked minute-by-minute browsing activity. Quartz reports that the good news is that even though ISPs can legally sell this data to whomever they want, right now they say they don't plan to sell it to anyone.
Right now.
So they found that 95% of the data they obtained that came from 10 popular browser extensions, they were able to connect it to people. They said it was trivial to link the people to the browsing history. They had to use a little bit of social engineering in order to do it, pretend like they were another company, but it seemed pretty easy. I do not think that browsing information that ISPs are now able to sell is at all private.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I feel like we've heard this quite a few times in the past where it's like, okay, you know, maybe there's no name associated with this information, but if you analyze these links long enough, there are clues, right? One of the clues that they pointed to is that when you log in on login pages, many times the URL will actually display the username within the URL of the logged in user. So that might be a reveal. They've also matched URLs that were in the history with similar URLs that were shared on social media sites at around the same time that the URL was followed in the browsing history. So then you compare those and you can have a pretty good estimation as far as who it might be, depending on the data set.
I mean, you know, I tend to think like, oh, I'm not sharing that much. But if you think about it, on Triangulation Today, I interviewed Nick Bilton, who wrote American Kingpin, which is about Ross Ulbricht. And he didn't even talk to Ross Ulbricht. He just had all of his chat logs. He had everything that was publicly available, plus some stuff that sources gave him. But he put it into this giant spreadsheet. So it was like he had EXIF data from photos, like which tells you where the photo was taken, what time it was taken, and who took it. And he just put it into a giant spreadsheet so you can match like what like, you know, all of his alter egos were doing at the same time. You know, so if you ever, I mean, I guess the moral of that story is if you plan to set up a giant Amazon for drugs, just stay off the internet.
Stay off the internet. Good advice. Actually, that's pretty sound. Find another way to do it, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody's leaving digital trails. That's just what we do when we're online. We're doing searches. We're clicking on links. You might not even think it. I think what's interesting about this is that I did some digging and I found an earlier article. I actually had to translate it from German into English. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Google, for doing that, because I couldn't have done that on my own. But it was written about this about middle of last year with the same researchers, and this was probably the beginning of their research. The company that they founded, it was a fake company, like you said, it was called Panorama. They were actually offered the data that they got from that. It was something like 3 million users or something, as a free sample from some of these services. You know, basically they were pretending to be these, you know, another, I don't know if you call it trafficker or whatever, but another ad metrics kind of data company online along with the rest. So it was apparently really easy to get this information. All they had to do was kind of be a fake company, be a new company coming in. They analyzed that data. The data was collected. All that data, what it was sourced from was a browser extension or add-ons. In this case, from this article anyways, an add-on called Web of Trust or WOT, which is basically something that someone's installing into their browser because they want to improve the security or improve the privacy, let's say in this case. But what ultimately is happening unbeknownst to them is every single time they click on something, that's sent off to a server. It's compartmentalized into buckets, and then that becomes a valuable resource later on. And then, as we can see here, it can be de-anonymized if you know what you're doing.
Right. We talked about Web of Trust, I think, mm-hmm. when that scandal came out, because it was just so ironic.
So untrustworthy?
Yeah.
Web of untrustworthiness?
Mm-hmm.
New details about Apple's plans for the next iPhone have been discovered, but this time Apple itself appears to possibly be responsible for the information coming to light. Early firmware for Apple's HomePod speaker hit the web late last week, and an iOS developer has analyzed the code to discover a number of references in the code to face detection. Seemingly, it confirms to some degree that infrared face detection might in fact be a part of the upcoming iPhone 8. What would the HomePod and iPhone 8 have to do with each other? HomePod apparently runs on a full iOS stack, so if this is pre-release firmware, then you could assume that this also applies to the upcoming iPhone. There are many mentions of biometric kit framework within there. That's actually where Touch ID lives, and the code details different states of face detection, things like too far from the camera, too close from the camera, multiple people in the camera, all these things that, you know, are basically different states of infrared face detection and how it operates.
So the face detection rumor has been around for about a month, but yeah. I didn't believe it. Maybe I just didn't want to believe it. But now I realize that it's probably going to happen. And I guess I don't know that it necessarily has to replace Touch ID. They could have both.
That's what
I guess
the rumors are saying.
Yeah,
right?
That it's going to replace Touch ID. And I think I have to trust Apple on this one, that they wouldn't replace something like Touch ID with something that doesn't work. And it's right. Not like we haven't seen this. I have Windows Hello on the Surface Book. It works beautifully. I just look and it opens up, and, you know, people don't love Windows Hello because it didn't really work when it came out, and people were like, oh, that doesn't work very well. And it wasn't on a lot of devices at first. And so I think that Apple probably knows this has to work out of the gate.
Absolutely.
And then in some ways, like, does it really have to work out of the gate? Like, people are so in love with their iPhones at this point, they'll probably stand for, you know, we gave up the headphone jack willingly. We accepted the dongles. We all complained about it mercilessly. And then it's like, okay, well, it's an iPhone, and I'll, for some reason, give up everything for an iPhone.
I think it's a little higher level of pushback that Apple would see if they actually outright replaced Touch ID with face detection and it didn't quite work so well. I mean, it's security. Security is a pretty big issue. And so I think people would really be a lot more worked up about that if that didn't happen out of the gate. There might be a little issue here and there, but I guess the main question remains whether we think Touch ID will be replaced in the upgraded iPhone for this face detection. I'm still not convinced that that would necessarily happen. I could see there being the option. But then at the same time, part of this is a reference to a small image outlining a device that is referred to as D22. D22 is the code name for the iPhone 8, apparently. It has a full front display with a notch up at the top for the earpiece and the sensors. So there is no fingerprint there. And in fact, that notch out of the top, which actually reminded me of Essential Phone, where it has a little notch out of the display, that could be where the infrared sensor is placed in this phone. That kind of seems to make you think there won't be a Touch ID, or if there is, it's not on the front. And I don't think Apple has plans to put it on the back either. So.
No, I think you're right. I think, well, I mean, Touch ID didn't work really well in the beginning either. And it doesn't work when your hands are sweaty. And it doesn't, right. You know, it's gotten much better and much faster. But I think it probably has to work. The facial detection has to work a certain percentage of time, you know. And I do think, like, you know, I don't think they'll hold back the iPhone, but they did hold back the AirPods. And, you know, you say AirPods, it's the same thing as the headphone jack. It's just how we listen to stuff. And it's not as important as security, but that's a great product. And it was delayed for a long time. They waited. They didn't just say, like, okay, I'll just send it out there and it might work sometimes and it might work not work other times. So, I think we only have a month or two to wait it out. So we'll see. But I have to believe that they know what they're doing. It might not work 100% of the time, but my guess is it's going to work like 78% of the time.
Yeah. I would give Apple the benefit of the doubt. I think they're smart enough and they're seasoned enough that they, on something this important, they wouldn't do an outright replacement unless it was working pretty, pretty darn good.
Mm-hmm. But the other question is, why did they leave all this stuff just out on a public server for people to see? Like that is...
It's always weird when that happens. Yeah. Yeah, when it comes directly from the company. It's like, wait a minute, did you know? Or was this planned? You know, who knows?
Yeah, somebody probably got fired, so I'm sorry. Get ready for ads in your GIFs. TechCrunch reports that Jiffy will soon test sponsored GIFs. Jiffy has over 200 million daily active users across platforms, so advertisers are understandably very eager to scoop up this real estate. The ads will work a little bit like they do in search. Sources at TechCrunch say a search for, like, woo might turn up sponsored tequila GIFs.
That's what I'm looking for when I say woo.
And like URL results, there'll be other GIFs that you can choose from. You're not going to be forced to have to use that one. It's a little like Snapchat. So the Snapchat filters you have, you know, there's the first one is sponsored usually, and it's very cool, but you don't have to use it. You can swipe through to use whatever filters you want. So Giphy is integrated on Facebook Messenger, Slack, Tinder, and Twitter. And we don't know when it's going to, these ads are going to be there. And it is just a test run. So
yeah, well, and one of the sources, at least to TechCrunch, has said that Giphy or Jiffy, depending on how you want to go, has officially shifted their kind of their strategy from growth, which is what they've been the last few years, into ad product development. So they're actively looking in this regard. I think this makes perfect sense. I mean, I feel like we were talking about how you monetize Jiffy a couple of months ago, and I was having a hard time then figuring out like what made the most sense. But if you're working in like actual legitimate deals with, you know, movie companies that have a film coming out or whatever, and you can create official animated GIFs around that movie coming up. I mean, one thing we know about people who use animated GIFs all the time is they're just looking for that thing that emotes the right response, or that, you know, that makes you laugh in a certain way or whatever. That seems like an excellent opportunity for viral marketing. Also improving the quality of GIFs that already exist, because everybody's making their own. Now you've got the actual companies creating their own content and making it look as good as they possibly can because they want it to look that good, you know. So there's money to be made there. And then Snapchat, you mentioned Snapchat and their filters. I would have thought, and I remember when that was first launching, I think my initial reaction to that was, oh, that'll never work. People just aren't going to use sponsored filters. But I think people actually do all right with them. Like, I think those sponsored filters actually do okay, and people use them because they can be quirky. It's just, it's not as shilly as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time consuming on Snapchat. I create.
Oh, you are a Snapchat creator.
I'm a Snapchat creator. Oh, thank you so much,
Brian. Thank you for the endless stream of animated GIFs.
Yeah. We picked this story just for Brian. But yeah, so I don't know if people use I haven't seen a lot of the ads. I will be honest. I am losing a little love for GIFs. I'm tiring of them, and I can't explain why, but I think also, especially on Twitter, like if one person uses a GIF that like one to say something hateful, like I've had people use them and I know that they're trolls. Mm-hmm. Anytime anyone else uses that same GIF,
it's like tainted.
Yeah. There's a couple of them and I'm just like, oh, I don't know. It's like this weird kind of visceral feeling. Do you have that or is it just me?
There are definitely some GIFs that happened at a very particular point in time that every time I see it, it makes me remember mm-hmm. that particular moment. But I don't know if it's soured my taste on animated mm-hmm. GIFs. They're used all the time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it feels like maybe they're being used when it's not necessary, or maybe it's completely inappropriate. But I don't know. It brings a little life to the internet, and mm-hmm. I like that. Otherwise, yeah. if everything's all still and boring.
It's true. So. I mean, some people will probably say the same thing about my Snapchat filters, but I will continue to use them. And if GIFs make you happy, keep
yes.
using them.
Yes, if it works for you, go ahead and GIF. Linden Labs, the company that brought the world's Second Life, for better or for worse, has had something cooking for the past 4 years and just opened its Sansar VR platform so that you can check it out. Like Second Life, Sansar is a virtual world filled with hundreds of creator-made experiences, things like museums, theaters, tropical destinations. They're also moving into games and stories. Anyone can design a virtual object to sell to other users, which is very similar to Second Life. And the world is playable both with a screen. You could play this just with a screen, but it was designed with VR in mind. So it's kind of taking the approach of Second Life, this like expansive world where everybody customizes their own aspect of it. And it's kind of making it more friendly on a virtual space in the virtual world.
Yeah, so I mean, we just heard of Altspace closing down, and so it's an interesting timing for them to open up a similar thing. But what they said, they're really focusing on the creator, like people creating their own worlds. It could be used in schools with groups, large groups, corporate groups. So yeah, I think it's exciting. I think that we need to slow down a little bit. Like, I just don't think VR is moving as fast, and so I think companies often suffer when a ton of cash is poured into them. So maybe we'll, and having the history of Second Life, having that pedigree might be good for them too. So like you said, it's on Windows but the Rift and the Vive. And I will be excited to see their future.
Yeah, I mean, Linden Labs has done, I can't believe that Second Life is still going, but Second Life has been a pretty cutting edge product for a really long time. It was there very early in the, I feel like anyways, in the virtual kind of community virtual space sort of thing. VR always made a whole lot of sense to me and the product of Second Life. So I'm not surprised at all that they're doing this and that they've spent so much time creating it. It feels like it's a little early. TechCrunch says that Sansar built its own engine instead of relying on engines like Unreal or Unity. So as such, there are certain things like gameplay mechanics, if you find a game in the a game inside of the experience, and other aspects of it that are a little limiting, but that'll probably develop out as they improve the engine over time. But another place that it's different is that in Second Life, buying land for creating stuff around inside the game can be somewhat expensive. You're buying the land and then everything else is relatively inexpensive. In Sansar, land is free to start with. Depending on the tier, you get like 3 personal lots or experiences for free. And then there's different paid tiers that give you access to more. And then assets to build up that world cost over time. So you can create objects and trade them out, or you can buy other people's objects, or pieces of the engine to create a game within your experience. It's definitely a creator's platform at this point. And I would imagine over time that it'll be really interesting to see where it develops out, especially considering the fact that we know that Linden Labs is able to let its products live their life, because Second Life has been around for so long and they've let it develop to where it is right now and haven't killed the product. I'm sure that this is going to have a good life too.
Do you think how is it different from Minecraft, aside from the fact that it's, the graphics are different?
That's a good question.
You look like a human and not like Steve.
That's a good question. I mean, the blockiness aspect. I mean, yeah, I realize I haven't played a whole lot with Minecraft to know the limitless ability, possibilities in Minecraft. I feel like things like Sansar are meant to be wide open to interpretation as far as what you want these experiences to do. Is it just a voyage? Is it a story that's being told? Is it a game? A part of it is building up your world, but another part of it is like building out the experience itself and what you get while you're there. And I don't know how much of that comes into play in Minecraft. I know in Minecraft there's a lot of building your world, once you're there, what do you just look at things, or you know what I mean? Here I think it's meant to be a whole platform. It could be a number of things.
It's, I mean, this whole world is really interesting. I guess he's my second cousin, is in video game design right now. And I was like, oh, video games have to have a story. And he was like, no, they do not. And I like really felt like an old person because he was, and I guess there's really sides of people that say like video games with stories are not really video games, you know, that it's something different.
That is more like a interactive cinema or something.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah, it's interesting worlds. Yep. After the break, tech blogger and winner of the Tesla Project Love Day contest, Marques Brownlee, is here to tell us about his experience at the Model 3 unveiling. But first, we'll take a minute to thank Grasshopper, the sponsor of this episode. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works like this, like your traditional phone system. You remember the ones in the old-fashioned days on your desk? I worked as a receptionist once, and I remember those phones well. But this is different. This is new. It requires no hardware purchase and no receptionist for that matter. With their iOS and Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. So you make a call and then your client sees your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number. All you have to do is select a toll-free or a local number, record a custom greeting, and then add multiple extensions for your business. If you haven't thought about toll-free numbers, they're great for making your business look and sound more professional. Most marketers will tell you toll-free numbers will really sell your business for you. Set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the whole wide world. Get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments. You can also send and receive SMS text messages from your business number. Join over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 a month. You have a 30-day money-back guarantee, so turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit, and we thank Grasshopper for their support.
Elon Musk, when we talked about this a little bit last week, held his big Tesla Model 3 event last Friday, showing off the sought-after sedan as it was delivered to the first crop of lucky owners. Marques Brownlee, you may know him as MKBHD, was there at the event and left with some serious bragging rights, which we'll talk about. He's here today to tell us about his experience. Welcome, Marques.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you back. So first of all, you've been to a million and maybe a million and one consumer tech events at this point. So I have to imagine this was a nice change of pace. Does Tesla put on a good show in this case?
Yeah, they do. So this was interesting because it wasn't really a consumer facing event. It was actually for employees. So the majority of the people there worked for Tesla already, and it was kind of Elon talking to them. But it was broadcast to the world, and it was still really entertaining.
Yeah, everybody got a window in, and I mean, you wouldn't have known that it wasn't a consumer facing event because everybody online was really anticipating finding out a little bit more about the Model 3, which they did. Which, by the way, you got the chance to actually drive one. Was it that morning? And tell us a little bit about your experience.
Yeah, it was. So it was like in the middle of that day, way before that nighttime event. I was in, I can't say his last name, but I'll say Franz, the lead designer over at Tesla, was my co-pilot. It was his car that we drove and did about a 15-minute loop around Fremont, around the factory, as we talked through the car and he explained what was different about it from the Model S, et cetera, which is kind of naturally what I compare most cars to anyway. And it was great. So it was pretty similar in responsiveness to the Model S. You kind of stomp on the pedal and you get an immediate response just because that's how electric cars are. But then obviously the interior of the car is super blank, super clean, super minimal. So if you're into that, that's great. But obviously it takes some getting used to because everything is on that screen, from the radio controls to AC to the mirrors and controlling where the AC goes. So it's really interesting, but it feels futuristic and it feels really similar to my current Tesla. So I was into it.
So was this one of the base $35,000 models or did it have a lot of upgrades, the one you drove?
I'm guessing the car I drove cost about $50,000 because it was the long range model. So it had the slightly beefier motors, 0-60 and 5.1. And it had the premium interior package, which meant it has the glass roof and the wood trim and the higher-end speaker system. So that right there puts it at $54,000, and it had autopilot. So it was pretty well equipped. They didn't really have any base cars to drive.
Now, you mentioned the interior layout, and when I was looking at it and, you know, kind of prepping for having you on today, I thought about what I feel like I know about you, Marquez, is that you do like kind of minimal as it intersects with technology. I mean, when you take a look at the interior of this vehicle, like saying minimal is kind of an understatement, because it's like the dash, yeah. It's just like a long, slender dash, and in the center panel is a big screen.
That's it.
I mean, is that appealing to you, and do you think people are going to get used to kind of like that center position screen as opposed to having the readouts in front of the driver's seat?
Yeah, so obviously every car has an instrument cluster right behind the steering wheel. So yeah. It was a little weird looking off to the side to see the blinker and the speedometer and all that. The explanation I got is obviously they intend for these cars to be autonomous in the near future. So hopefully it won't be as weird to sit in the driver's seat and not really have to look down too much. So, you know, the bare interior, not a whole lot of buttons, was obviously appealing to the minimalist in me. But yeah, you see the interior. It still does definitely have a little bit of a learning curve to look over there for literally all the functions of the car. But, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like I could see myself getting used to it. I only have two screens in my car now. If you subtract one, kind of just means you look to the same place every time.
Yeah.
So I know before we started the show, you hadn't put your video up yet for your review. So I always wonder, how is it different to review this Model 3 Tesla versus like an iPhone?
Oh, no, it's up now.
Yeah.
Oh, it's up?
Yeah, 14 minutes ago.
I just dropped the video a couple minutes ago. That's right. it definitely is different, mostly because, I guess, first of all, at this event, it was interesting because when we did those test drives, it was no photos or videos allowed during the day. So obviously all the journalists who are writing their articles had a field day and they wrote everything they needed to. I, on the other hand, came back to the studio and was talking through my experience with the car, so that was a little different. But I am doing more car stuff now, which is a lot more fun, but also a lot more work because you're shooting different angles. It requires a team.
Yeah.
Shooting a phone doesn't require a team. It requires someone to drive a car, someone to shoot the video of the car while driving. So it's more work, but it also is a lot of fun.
Yeah, right. I can imagine that. What about the Model 3 took you by surprise, if anything? What's something that really stood out to you?
Not a lot, mostly because I've followed it a lot. I think the one weird quirk was the AC, the way it works. So I've talked to this point a little bit, but you know how in most cars you have the AC and you have the little vents on, you know, a vent here, a vent there, and you kind of adjust the flaps where you want the air to point? Mm-hmm. This car just has one big slot all the way across the center and no flaps to point, but if you go in the touchscreen, you can sort of adjust where the airflow goes, up or at you or to the outside, which was just really interesting, I guess. And then there's also no glove box button. That's a button on the touchscreen also. So little things like that. Like, it's clearly super, super clean and sleek and minimal, but it still has a learning curve because of that.
Yeah, you better hope nothing ever happens to that touchscreen. Otherwise,
yeah,
you're hosed. Well, and I mean, another and along that same line, the smartphone in this case is your key. So it's your key to get in and it's your key to start the car and drive away or whatever. Do you feel like everybody's ready for that kind of a shift? I feel like that's a big jump.
I don't think everyone's ready right now, but this is a super forward face. A lot of things about this car are like ready for 2019 or 2020. So the autonomy, that's number one. Having a smartphone, or the other option is this sort of credit card sized card, which has RFID and you walk up to the car and it unlocks. So it has the same functionality as I guess a normal key fob.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole smartphone controlling your car thing is new to most people.
So you already have a Tesla, and this is of course the least expensive model. Is it something you would just, I don't know if you would upgrade to, I don't know if you'd say upgrade, but is it something, is the Model 3 something that you would consider yourself, would consider driving?
Because I own a Model S, no, I'm not getting a Model 3. I do know a lot of people who were considering a Model S, never pulled the trigger because it was a little out of price range or they didn't have that option. And now that Model 3 is an option, they are getting it. So I'm not someone who's buying it, but I know a couple of people who are on board.
Yeah. Now, you not only got to drive one, as you have told us about, you walked away from the event a winner. You didn't win a car. But tell us how you came to create the winning commercial in the Project Love Day ad contest, and what did you win?
Yeah, that was a fun one. So I haven't done a whole lot of car videos, but when I got my Tesla it kind of acts like a piece of tech. So I decided to start making videos about it. And then, of course, you know, up comes this contest that Tesla's holding where anyone can just make a 90-second or less sort of fan-made ad. I was like, okay, obviously I'm going to just go ahead and try to make one with my car. And there were a lot of really conceptual, really dreamy, really interesting videos made about the whole idea of sustainable future and electric cars in general, which were really cool. One of my favorite entries was one about like spaceships for Earth. So a lot of fun stuff. I was kind of game planning mine, and then we ran up against a deadline, and we ran out of time to make it. So we were going to basically cancel the whole project. And then a couple of hours after we decided to cancel it, Tesla extended the deadline by another couple weeks. So we were like, all right, we have to make one. We went out, made this video, and it took us about 3 days to get everything shot and edited, just because a lot of what you're looking at is like on actual roads and we have to plan all this stuff. But I think it turned out really well, and it was kind of a thrill to see it played on the big screen in front of all those employees, and I think everyone liked it, so it was really entertaining.
I think you have to work on your mean guy look a little bit, like when you're that yeah. one moment. Like,
I didn't have the mean mug going. I guess I should have, but yeah, that was a fun moment.
It's so great. It also could be a FedEx ad. It could be a Cheerios ad. I think you've got it all there.
Yep.
You were an equal opportunity ad creator, if that is such a thing. Well, this is really awesome stuff. We really appreciate you coming on, and congratulations on the win. By the way, did you win anything, or is it just bragging rights?
Mostly that. I think I unofficially got an invite to the next Tesla event, which is the semi-truck unveiling, which is pretty cool. So I'll go to that. But mainly just favoriting the tweet from Elon was what I got out of that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's pretty awesome, man. Thanks for coming on, and congratulations again, Marquez Brownlee. Where do you want people to go to find your review and all of your work?
You can check out the video I just dropped on everything I know about the Model 3. So youtube.com/, there it is at the top, MKBHD, or really any social /MKBHD. That's what's up.
Right on. Thanks again, Marquez. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, guys.
All right, have a good night. All right, feedback time. Rick wrote in saying, just letting you all know, we in Atlanta got our Amazon truck. He says, yes, the stuff comes out from the back of the truck. He says, this weekend with the Nintendo Classic and for, wait for it, $59.99. Finally, after almost a year since you all let us know about it, I finally got it. Here are some pics of the truck and my two happy boys as can be. Two boys happy as can be. So an Amazon truck, what
oh, were you not here when we were talking about the treasure truck?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, so the treasure truck, it was only in Seattle for a while, and they would have usually just one item, and they would give away free candy. So, yeah, all the things you've taught about to your kids about don't take free candy from someone or buy things off the back of a truck, Amazon is subverting that.
Thanks, Amazon.
So now they're going to different areas. And so I don't know how much is a classic NES, and weren't they not available anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the bigger thing, is that they were really on short supply and you couldn't find them. And I mean, they're not selling them anymore, but I mean, $60 has to be close to cost. I think that was about the cost of the device. When it was new and they weren't being marked up like they probably are on eBay, you know?
Yeah, so it's the treasure truck. It's just one of the many ways that Amazon is going to be selling things from all places. You won't be able to swing a dead cat without hitting a place to buy something from Amazon.
Okay. And I'm not going to swing a dead cat, though.
My father-in-law always says that. And I guess if you're a cat lover, it could be offensive, so I'm sorry. But no felines were harmed in that, what do you call it? I don't know.
That promotional truck thing?
Yes, I was thinking, what do you say when you can't swing a dead cat? What are those called? Like, oh, I don't know. Homily.
All right. There
homily.
We go.
Homily. I knew John could help me out there. No felines were harmed in that homily. TNT's fan of the day is Garrett Williams on Twitter, who sent us this YouTube video of him practicing his pool shots. 6 minutes of his practice, in fact. Garrett said, I'm listening on my phone. Please note the show ends, and I miss you. Yeah. I miss.
Yeah, basically at the very, very end, right before it ends, the show finishes on his iPhone, on his mobile phone, which he has next to him. And he's made all the shots up until that point, but the show ends and then he tries and he misses. So we are, he's pretty upset.
Can you hear? I can't hear us. Is he just playing pool?
Well, because it's not on anymore. Oh. We're done. The show's over.
Oh.
But in the beginning, yeah, we're playing here. See, isn't that inspirational?
Mm-hmm.
The inspirational sounds of us.
Tech News Today, it will help your pool game.
Yes, apparently so.
According to Garrett. Garrett
Until it's
says,
over, yes.
Yeah. Well, show us how you watch or listen to TNT, record a video, or take a picture of yourself or your setup or whatever you happen to be doing. Well, not whatever you happen to be doing, but you know. Within reason. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT, and we're going to find it.
I think the solution is you put us on repeat, and then when it's done, it starts over again, and you'll never lose, ever. Niantic is going to take some time learning from the many challenges it experienced at its recent Pokemon Go Fest in Chicago earlier this month. We had Renee Ritchie on to talk about the fabulous disaster that was that event. And as such, the upcoming European events, which were scheduled to happen at least early August, are now being postponed. Copenhagen and Prague had events scheduled on August 5th. Stockholm and Amsterdam had their own events on August 12th. Now, both of those events are going to be, or all of those events anyways, are going to be pushed back to later this fall. No specific dates listed. But they have events in Japan, August 14th, and they have France, Spain, and Germany happening September 16th. Those are still going forward as planned. So August 12th, too soon. August 14th, okay, apparently. I don't know, but hey.
Well, I mean, I think they're doing right by their fans.
I believe so.
Who, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also, there's a class action lawsuit that's happening right now.
Come on.
Because they're saying the event didn't deliver on its promises.
Well, find something else. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the super rare Pokemon was not enough for for those class actioners. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us, tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW, and find us on Twitter at TechNewsTodayTV.
Subscribe to our show. Subscribe to all our shows, twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me, if you're offended by my judging nod about class action lawsuits, please. Tweet at me. I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director, Brian, also editor. Yes.
Yes.
Okay, I should check this before we come in here. Thanks to Jammer B for helping out here in the studio. Always appreciate your help, man. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We will see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everybody.